From a supply perspective, it's a little complicated because we're probably down at least 10 million barrels a day of supply in terms of just pure production. And we may be down close to 13 or 14 million barrels a day, depending on exactly how much oil is getting produced in Iran and how much sort of has been impacted of both oil and natural gas liquids. So we're close to, let's say, 90 million barrels a day, plus or maybe like closer to 92 million barrels a day of supply. So let's say down 13, 14 something million barrels a day. We've already depleted, we're getting close to 7 billion barrels a day, or sorry, 7 billion barrels total in storage across oil products, strategic petroleum reserves, and so on. So that's a massive change in a few months.
Josh Young, Bison Interests. Good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure, and I have been really looking forward to this. What a crazy, exciting time that we live in as far as the energy markets are concerned. Let me give you a little bit of thesis. It's my thesis where I'm coming from. I don't want to say I'm a permabull of oil, but I thought we would work out. I would say I thought we'd be where we're at now. I thought we would be towards the end of the year, if not maybe the beginning of next year. That was my assumptions. Little did I know we'd have a war coming on, and little did I know that all of this drama going on. Wanted to get your thoughts and comments. Let's start with that. Where are we at right now with the oil markets?
Yeah, so I agree. I think that we were in this sort of very weird, pessimistic spot ahead of the Iran war, and everyone was sort of rushing to short oil, anticipating a super glut that didn't exist and hadn't happened and was unlikely to happen. And I think people sort of got confused. Oil behaves in cycles, and so you have typically a cycle of underinvestment, which leads to low supply and high price, and those high prices lead to overinvestment, which leads to oversupply and lower prices. And so everyone got all excited about shorting oil and talking about a glut or a super glut. We were close to 15 years in to a down cycle in oil. And so when you sort of check your compass and say, hey, wait a second, we're at the end of this, not the beginning of it, it was pretty amazing. And I think it's important in understanding what's going on now in market psychology and many folks' responses to this and in a lot of misunderstandings, because if you don't know where you were, it's hard to know where you are, and it's certainly almost impossible to tell where you're going to be.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start with that. Where were we? We'll do a brief recap. Where were we pre-conflict with or war? We'll call it a war in Iran, Middle East. Where were we?
Sure. So we were running around a balanced market of close to 106 million barrels a day of crude oil, condensate, and natural gas liquids. And we had a global inventory level that was slightly elevated at about 8.3 billion barrels total, including strategic petroleum reserves, including commercial inventories, just sort of across the board, across crude oil and gasoline storage and jet fuel storage and the gasoline at the local gas pump, sort of all the way through. We were sitting at around 8.3 billion barrels of oil and oil products in storage.
Okay, so that's where we were, and then the conflict happened. Straits of Hormuz were shut down. Whether it's open or not, that's really anybody's, I would even dare to say guess. I'm going to say that it's not. Where are we at now then, as far as inventories and as far as supply and demand? And you do have, I want to preface this, it does seem like there's this weird dichotomy with supply. Oil storage is running low, but yet you seem to have a slowing economics. So that provides that dynamic. But work all that out for me. Where are we at now?
Yeah, sure. So, from a supply perspective, it's a little complicated because we're probably down at least 10 million barrels a day of supply in terms of just pure production. And we may be down close to 13 or 14 million barrels a day, depending on exactly how much oil is getting produced in Iran and how much sort of has been impacted of both oil and natural gas liquids. So we're close to, let's say, 90 million barrels a day, plus or maybe like closer to 92 million barrels a day of supply. So let's say down 13, 14 something million barrels a day. We've already depleted, we're getting close to 7 billion barrels a day, or sorry, 7 billion barrels total in storage across oil products, strategic petroleum reserves, and so on. So that's a massive change in a few months. And every month that this goes on, we're depleting storage by at least 300 million barrels, and realistically, probably closer to 500 million barrels a month. But importantly, one area there that I actually want to correct, we have very little demand destruction right now. So very early on in the war, there was some because there were countries that literally couldn't get, let's say, jet fuel or gasoline or oil for certain refineries. And what we've seen is that supplies have balanced out, and we've been shifting a lot of US both crude oil and refined products, exporting them globally. And then China looks like has restarted refined product exports. And so we're actually close to, let's say, maybe 2 million barrels a day of demand. It's not really destruction because people, they would consume it if they could. And so that's really not much in a 106 million barrel a day market. So maybe we're down to 104, and supply might be, again, somewhere between 90 and 95, which is a really wide range, admittedly, but million barrels a day. And so we're in this like deep downturn from a supply perspective, and a very, very modest downturn that looks entirely availability related from a demand perspective.
Okay, so I just gave a pretty big chuckle, and it's not of what you said. It's just like I'm just blown away about these numbers. It just sounds really intense is the word, but maybe that's the right word. We don't have a whole lot of oil in storage. That's what I'm hearing from you, and that's what my assumption is. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's been some theories recently promulgated that we don't need oil in storage. And there was one paper in particular that
I'm
disseminated
laughing.
broadly
I'm
over the
sorry. That's preposterous, but go ahead. Go ahead. I'm not laughing at
right. There was this one paper that was disseminated over the weekend. So in the last week, the CEOs of Exxon and Chevron, who are, or by the way, like generally the lean bearish oil, and they're extremely conservative, for better or for worse, but extremely conservative, came out and said within weeks they expect $150 plus physical oil within weeks. And so that was on one hand. And then on the other hand, there was this paper that was disseminated from these very popular newsletters that we actually only need a few hundred million barrels of oil in storage. And so the reason to talk about this is because I shared, two numbers, 8.3 billion barrels, which is what we were at, and then close to 7 billion barrels, which is where we're at approximately. And just to give context in those numbers, the sort of consensus around sort of the investment bank world is that at 6 to 6.5 billion barrels, that's tank bottoms. That's the rest of the oil you need, and the gasoline and so on you need, so that you have gas at the gas station. They don't get gas every minute. They get gas delivered once a week, and so they're sitting on gas or once every 2 weeks, and then the refiner gets oil once a month, once a week, depending on the refinery and sort of how big they are, and what their transportation status is, whether they're getting it via pipe or whether they're getting it via ship or so on. And then similar sort of across the whole value chain. And that's billions of barrels. And so my observation to, I have this newsletter I launched a year ago, and I got asked this 10 different times, which was amazing. So my answer was, look, like if it turns out that there's highly economic oil right now where you can sell your oil today still for a huge premium to what you can sell it for a month from now in the forward market, in the futures market and the forward curve, then the CEOs of Exxon and Chevron and many of these other companies would love to hear it. It's the world's best consulting project where you can teach them how they really only need a tenth as much oil as they currently use in their businesses to deliver gasoline and diesel. And so just the degree, the reason to even reference that is the degree of misunderstanding around this. Like these are barrels that are necessary for the global economy to function, and then taking a step down, just they're necessary for the global oil markets to function. And so whether it's 6 billion barrels, which is sort of the low end on the investment bank research, or 5 billion barrels, which is where I think you could probably get to without too much stuff breaking, or certainly not 500 million barrels like some futures traders apparently dreamcasted or something. But there's some number where you start having real logistical issues where you've gone beyond just in time, and you go from just in time to just empty and not actually delivering the products that are needed at the time that they're desired to be consumed.
Okay, and this is happening right now. Josh. Okay, so this is like, okay, this is where we're at. So then you bring up a great point. I've go to fill up my car sometime in July or August. There's a reasonable chance there'll be no gasoline for me to pump into my car because they don't have it. That's what I hear you saying. Is that correct?
Well, depending on where in the world you are. So if you're
Yeah,
here
of
in the
course.
US, you're probably
Georgia. I'm in.
fine.
Okay. Oh, no.
You're probably fine because in the US, we're a net exporter of refined products. We're a net exporter of hydrocarbons broadly. We import a little crude oil, but most of that's from Venezuela and from Canada. They're sort of stuck for one reason or another. And so, we're probably fine. It's probably going to be more expensive, but in gas stations in Europe and parts of Asia and certainly parts of Africa and South America, there's real risk of shortage. And then actually just one more point
Please.
before we move on to that, which is that there's a logistical delay in between whenever the day is that normal traffic resumes in the Strait of Hormuz, which hopefully, from a humanitarian perspective,
Oh,
I
yeah.
hope
Open it
that's
up.
today, right? Like, this is like, I hope that it reopens,
We're
but
talking data. Yeah.
there's also just the economic reality of like, let's just deal with what's going on now and understand it and sort of project out. And so, probably it takes 2 to 3 months for supplies to normalize. And so that shortage you were describing, it's sort of baked in the cake. You're probably going to see another billion or so barrels of inventory declines. Maybe it's half a billion, right? Maybe on the low end. And
Right.
in which case, by my numbers, we're actually probably going to be okay and there won't be any shortages. But that's if the strait opened like today. Since it's not opening today, to the best that I checked on Trump's truths and various other sort of stuff, then every day beyond that, again, I would just sort of figure another at least 45 days, potentially as long as 90 days of net effective delays in resumption of normal sort of global oil supplies. Some of that's tanker related, some of that's that it will take weeks or months for these different fields that have been turned off or mostly turned off to turn back on. And that's assuming that there aren't significant things that broke in the process, that wells won't need to get
Yeah.
redrilled, that there will be some workovers, but relatively minor, that there isn't more infrastructure that gets attacked. And then there's one other thing that's worth talking about here,
I'm taking notes. Go ahead. Yep.
that isn't It's oil market related, but it's also there's this weird open question. There was a lot of stuff that happened today and in the last few weeks where it seems like the Trump administration's really getting dragged along by the IRGC, by Iran's sort of military leadership. And it raises some really uncomfortable questions as an American and as a human living in 2026 of wait. Like, what were we lied to about during this war? Like, how bad did it actually get? And so there were these weird things, even in these interviews of these oil super major CEOs, where they talked about how there were unreported attacks as recently as this past week. And then I came across one just trolling around on X this morning. This commodities trader I follow in Switzerland, they do a lot of sort of they do a lot of GPS work where they sort of like look around at some of these open source satellites and they publish a lot of it. So that's why I follow them. And they had found this other account that had apparently there was a tanker leaking oil on the Oman side of the strait and on the sort of, I guess, the Indian Ocean side of the strait, not on the Persian Gulf side of the strait, and that had been there. It looked like stuck for a day or two, and there was this history on the satellites of a few of these sort of swift boats that the IRGC operates coming close to it, and then oil leaking afterwards. And so, the reason to talk about this is it's possible that there's a lot more damage that's taken place to regional energy infrastructure because if there's literally boats sitting there leaking oil into the ocean because they've been attacked and we're not hearing about it. And we've heard about all these attacks, but if that's going on, then what else has been attacked? And why on earth is the president of the United States so scared of these folks where we killed a huge number of the leadership of the IRGC in the 39 or whatever days that I actually believe, but like, what didn't we hear about and what wasn't reported in this war that has us so scared? And specific to oil, what oil infrastructure was hit? What was, we've heard about these, attacks on various sites, and my inclination generally is that they're quite quick to rebuild and to get back online. There's all these refineries that blow up and have fires and whatever, and somehow in a month they're magically sort of back online, a lot of hard work and planning and so on, here in the US and elsewhere. And so my bias was towards that, but it sure looks like there might have been a lot more that was attacked. And again, why does that matter? Well, maybe it takes 6 months to get supplies back up and running fully, or a year. Or not, right? But like, let's at least consider that it could take a lot longer and that there's been a lot more damage than we thought, in which case that sort of pushes the likely inventory low at the after the reopening down to even lower levels because maybe it'll take 6 months before we really have full supplies back online from the various countries in the Middle East.
Okay, so let's assume the worst here as far as that this is being underreported. Who does that affect the most? And what I mean by that, what area of the world, what countries? Is that a European problem? Is that a problem in Australia or China? Or is that a global problem here, even in the US?
So it's probably a small economic problem for some American consumers. Realistically, all this is quite good for the US economy in my calculations. So as a net exporter of a thing, similar to, if Saudis had their full export capacity, if oil was up, no one would say, hey, the Saudis had to pay a little more for bread, therefore it's bad for them that their oil prices are higher. No, of course not, right? So everyone knows that. So the US is really, I mean, we are dominant from an energy producer perspective. We produce more energy than I think it's between oil and natural gas liquids and natural gas than Russia and Saudi Arabia, I think, combined. And then maybe those two countries plus some of the next largest country. So we're really producing a lot, we're exporting a lot. And so it's actually quite good here, broadly, again, for folks on fixed incomes, for folks with particular inflation exposure, then it could be really negative for them personally, but across the economy, it's fine. I think the economies that are impacted the most are the very poor oil-intensive economies. So, it's fun to talk about Europe getting hurt because they've chosen the sort of self-destruction via socialism of their. They like looked at what happened to Eastern Europe under communism and thought that looked fun, and they opted in on that. But that's sort of that's its own path. It's not really. They're still wealthy enough for now to, I think, stomach this. I think it's really, you look at some of the more economically sensitive countries in South America and sub-Saharan Africa, as well as the easy ones to point to are, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, just because those were most impacted by the cessation of Gulf flows because they're really close to the Persian Gulf, and then they're also very poor. And the data is actually not bad in terms of tracking the imports and exports. Whereas if you try to track XYZ country in Western Africa or something, that may get a lot harder.
Good luck. Yeah. So really what you're saying is, and I mean this from a humanitarian, it's really going to hit the poorer countries in the world more than likely, as you just pointed out, probably Africa and maybe some of the East Asia or Western Asia, which would be like, well, that East Asia, that, I think that's Pakistan and so on, but it's really going to hit them. Oh man. Okay. So let's make some other assumptions here. Let's say the Straits of Hormuz gets opened, everything's free and free flowing. Do we go back to a normalization? And what I mean by that, I would say a floor around oil is around, in the US here, is around $60 a barrel. Do we go back to a normal, assuming everything gets reopened over the next few weeks, few to several weeks? Or is that always behind us now?
It's a really good question. I'm not that comfortable with a floor in oil. There's this book sitting right behind me, Crude Volatility, talking about sort of the impact that oligopolies and cartels have had on oil prices over time, and arguing that, the OPECs of the world, and before that, the Railroad Commission, and some of the other sort of, and before that, Standard Oil, those sort of price control mechanisms were necessary to mitigate wild price volatility in oil. And I think we're going towards a more volatile time for oil, but also likely average higher prices. And so
That's a good answer.
I'm not convinced on the. I've seen these arguments on, oh, there's a floor at 80. It reminds me, like in 2022, there were a number of folks that were saying, oh, oil will never get below 100 again. Honestly, at that point, I should have just sold everything and run, waited until the super glut thesis last year and bought back. So the floor at 80, it's not as extreme as floor at 100, 20% inflation ago. So it doesn't make me too scared. It just seems like it's not fully encapsulating the dynamism of the world's largest commodity with all kinds of different parties involved in setting the price and adjusting the price and so on. That being said, I think the price for oil right now is too low. And so I think there's a real risk that you see an initial sort of sell-off on, let's say there's a green light and the Strait of Hormuz is now open somehow magically, which again seems sadly increasingly unlikely anytime soon. But let's say that happens and there's 50 tankers that leave the Strait all in one day and none of them are attacked and there's no mines that hit them and whatever. Let's call that the reopening, and then the next day there's another 50. Oil goes down a bunch probably on the back of that over the next few days. And then at that point, it probably, and this is from some of the CEOs of some of the, let's say, mid-cap oil producers and some of the services companies I met with at this conference last week. I meet with all the time at lunches and dinners and meetings here in Houston. They all think that it gets bid at that point, and that we end up in a sort of potentially sort of cycle similar to what we saw 2020 to 2022. They think there's sort of an organic bid, and that there's a lot of folks who want to buy oil and who want to buy their stocks who are waiting for that, essentially treating it like a green light to go buy the stocks. They think that there will be a very brief buy window on the back of it, and then prices go much higher. So that's not a floor per se, that's a sort of potential price trend. And the fundamentals support that, but no one knows for sure what's going to happen there. And there is a risk that there's a sell-off and that it's a pretty brutal sell-off for some time before you see a turnaround due to fundamentals.
Sure, I get that. I do. And I do own oil, just to all my viewers and listeners. I wish I owned more, but I do own oil. And I'm actually waiting, exactly what you said. I'm waiting for if we have a sale off. I don't like chasing is really the position I'm in it as an investor. I'd like paying. But the implications of this conflict, and also I guess what I'm trying to get at is the implications are for stronger oil prices, right? Moving forward. And it seems like, again, that when I had you on, this was, I want to say, last December or January, I can't remember the exact month, we discussed, again, working out extra surplus or whatever, but just we talked about the supply problem. But it would hit more than likely hit towards the end of the year, maybe in the early next year. But it seems like everything's sped up, and I'm not saying that we have high oil prices for the rest of our lives here, but it does seem like we got an oil problem, is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, so it really it's one of those things where by speeding it up, it actually adds a little more uncertainty. There was an extremely high probability call late last year, early this year, as everyone was getting so vocally bearish, right? And as positioning was completely offsides, as US oil production was starting to roll off, and as global projects were getting deferred, there was an increasing probability of higher prices for longer. And so one of the very obvious effects, and it's been muted versus history, but it's still coming. One of the obvious effects of higher prices is we are seeing more drilling activity right now than I think we would have if oil prices were, let's say, $20 a barrel lower. And again, it's like Captain Obvious here, but you get higher oil prices, you get more drilling activity. And so that part obviously is net bearish for oil, let's say a year out, because it increases supplies. And yeah, do you need, if the strait opens tomorrow, do you need those supplies to refill storage? Yes, but that trajectory of refilling storage is going to be quite bearish from an oil price perspective. Maybe it's bearish from a much higher level, but it's still bearish. And so the real question and the uncertainty for me, I'm still very bullish further out. There's just a little more uncertainty. And the reason is that these next wells are to get drilled. No one really knows if they're going to be highly productive or modestly productive, or have low productivity. And the incremental wells, so let's say as we went from the low of, I think it was 408 oil rigs that were operating here in the US in February, and we're now there's something like 435 or something that are running. So the 435th rig running is much less productive than the first and second and third and so on. There's just by nature you can rank them all, and so the 435th is the 435th least productive. Incremental wells, incremental inventory that's drilled is less productive than the stuff that was going to get drilled no matter what oil was at. And so the real question is, how bad will, let's say, the 500th well be, the 500th rig that's running, and the 12, locations that say, or 20 locations that they drill this year, next year, how will those wells look? Will they be 100 barrel a day wells, or 500 barrel a day wells, or 1,000 barrel a day wells? And then if they start at 1,000, similar to, let's say, many others, will they decline to 100 after 3 months, or will they decline to 100 after a year? That productivity and that decline rate will really, I think, dictate what the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years look like for oil, maybe more than if the strait stays closed for 10 more days or 20 more days. It really, I think that marginal productivity decline is going to matter so much, because that declining productivity is real. The trend's already there. But if we're already off the cliff and we're declining rapidly, then we're going to need to go do a lot more exploration investment and exploratory drilling in order to be able to get into the next oversupplied market, which sounds great, right? But it also sounds like you're going to need much higher prices for a lot longer in that scenario. And, I'll just say we don't, I lean towards that, but we don't know for sure. And, let's see what these next 50 rigs and then next 50 after that due in terms of incremental production. And we won't even see that for the first 6 months or maybe even year after they come on. So we'll see. We can have a hypothesis and then it'll get tested in the market via the production data, and then we'll see, I think, the prices set, excluding this Hormuz crisis, we'll see the prices set on the back of the productivity that it turns out on those incremental rigs that get deployed.
And speaking of that, even just with the wells that are open and they got shut down, it's not like I think you can shut an oil rig down, but it can't just open it back up. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it just depends. So again, my concern is that some of these fields in the Middle East got hit a lot harder than we were thinking, and it certainly appears that the reporting in the area, not necessarily due to the fault of the media companies, but I think there's just stuff that's either gotten, that the government's saying, hey, you can't report on this, or is just not available to those reporters to be able to report on. But it does appear that there may have been some additional infrastructure. Certainly, there are additional ships that are not getting that were damaged that were not are not getting reported on. And so the actual wells turning them back on, it really depends. There are some water floods and some secondary and tertiary recoveries, so where they're pumping chemicals or seawater or various other things downhole in order to get more oil out. There are some projects like that that you can't really shut off, but it appears, to what I can tell, that they're actually doing it the right way, where they're sort of cycling them on and off, so they're not fully shut down. And so the impact of the shutdowns should be less of the slowdown, essentially, and production should be less severe. So that'll be the most in, let's say, Saudi Arabia, and the least in, let's say, Iraq or Bahrain, where there's almost, or Kuwait, where there's almost zero oil coming out. So we'll see. It is a thing that you don't really want to shut in, especially secondary recovery or tertiary recovery oil wells, because of that issue in terms of what happens when you turn them back on. But I think they're planning for that. There's not some sort of magic like, oh, they're off, therefore you lose 5 or 10 million barrels a day for forever sort of thing. I think most of that oil is going to be recoverable, absent the oil facility damage and productivity, the production capacity damage that I'm starting to think maybe should be attributed, based on the erratic behavior of the president of the United States, as well as the sort of incremental data points that people are like literally stumbling upon, essentially. I mean, it's not by accident, because they're looking at these GPS and they're looking at these at the other, the open source satellites, and they're studying them and they're finding them. But they're just sort of stumbling upon them while looking. They're not, knowing necessarily, as far as I know, where to go, which means there's probably a lot more of this stuff out there. And again, so the stuff that was attacked, I worry, got hurt a lot worse, and that then has been reported. And then there's so we'll see. I guess it's just there's a wide cone of uncertainty. That's why I was saying there could be as much as, a few million barrels a day of variance in current supply, and then a couple of million barrels a day in variance in demand. And it's so weird because these are such big numbers, right? 1 million barrels a day at $100 a barrel is $100 million a day. That's the numbers add up really fast when you start thinking about that. And the reality is that we just don't know.
So you said two things that really stuck out in my mind. You talked about demand destruction, and we haven't really seen it. That's interesting to me. I want to talk a little bit more of that. Where's that coming from? Is it coming from countries just say, hey, we better get it while we got it? Or people just saying, or consumers just saying, we better get it while it is still there. And the second thing you mentioned, you just came from a conference and you're talking to all of these oil companies. What's their plan or strategy around this? Is it just drill, baby, drill, or are they aggressively looking for more, and where, if they are looking for more?
Yeah. So the second is sort of easier. The reality is that most of these companies are just doing exactly what they were doing pre-war. And what you're seeing is the companies that have been picking up additional rigs are mostly funded. They're not the public companies for the most part. There's a few public companies that have each picked up a few rigs. The private ones, one by one, their private equity sponsor or their private owner calls up the CEO and says, "Hey, prices are high, let's drill a little more." And the CEO is like, maybe not, or vice versa, right? It goes both ways. And for the most part, they seem to each be picking up one or two additional rigs. And it's pretty funny when you talk to these CEOs, they say, "Hey, I'm adding a rig, but no one else is." And it's like, okay, good story. I was at a conference a few weeks ago where they were saying this, and like I got by the time the fifth guy said it, I just laughed out loud at him. I think he was like a cousin. I'm not that good at this, but it was really, really remarkable. So that was where I knew, by the way, that the Baker Hughes number, the rig count at that point, it was still like 415 or something for oil rigs, which was way too low. It made no sense. And when people started telling me about how their competitors weren't drilling more oil wells, I was like, that's I'll just go buy more oil stocks. Sorry, more oil drilling rig stocks, and I'll wait for those numbers to roll in. So companies are drilling a little more, but it's not the exploratory stuff that's necessary in order to add inventory. It's mostly just sort of accelerating the depletion and development of existing fields, and just sort of, if they had companies that had 8 years of inventory at the current rate, maybe they'll have four or six or something like that. And that's where, again, I think that there's a real risk that incremental activity is a lot less productive because they're drilling. If they had 1 year of amazing inventory, they were already drilling it. So now they're bringing on these, let's say, one more rig, and maybe they have 1 year of good inventory. So they have the one rig drilling amazing inventory and one rig drilling good inventory. Well, what happens next year? They'll have to go to the okay-ish inventory, and then the less good inventory with those two rigs. And then, if they have eight and it ranks from terrible to amazing, that's sort of the way I think about that getting deployed. And when I chat with these guys, they don't like to say that. They say, "Oh, well, all of those 8 years are economic below X price." But then they'll like the more they talk, the more it becomes clear that they're just trying to use nice words to describe a spectrum of good to bad, using words that all rhyme with good and are just there. Like there's very good, and then less good, and then even less good, but they all have good in it just in case.
Right. Okay, so tee this up for investors. What should investors be looking at? Again, divorcing the humanitarian and high oil prices and all the things involved with that. But what should investors really be looking at as opposed to the huge, as opposed to buying Exxon, which I'm not advocating or not, I'm not saying to do or not to do that. But yeah, what should investors be looking at? Is it really in oil services or is it an exploration? You marked exploration because nobody's exploring right yet. It seems to me that there's still those would be still pretty cheap. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so I can't tell anyone what they should do, but I can tell you what I'm doing. And so I'm doing, two things basically. So one, the large producers, like you mentioned, like the Exxon, Chevrons, and so on, it's been very interesting to see how they've traded because they went up a lot before the war, and then maybe it's because of their supplies getting disrupted, maybe it's because their valuations were too high. They actually haven't really been. The stocks haven't gone up much, if at all, since the war started, end of February. And so they've not been a great place to have exposure, and it's not an area that I have meaningful exposure. What I did starting out with this is I went and found even sort of more. I tend to invest in companies that are survivable, that are decently well run at very low valuations and with some sort of catalyst to unlock the value. So that's sort of my general framework across oil businesses and services businesses and so on. And so I leaned a little more towards the companies that are, let's say, a little junkier, but have a little more upside potential from higher oil prices, where I didn't think that was priced in on the producer side. And then when I realized that we were at the early stages of this big inflection in drilling activity here in the US, I got really interested in oil field services. And I already owned some drilling rig stocks because I thought they were just too cheap, but I got I added a lot more exposure just because they had it sort of in the bag, in the way that, imagine if you could know that for the next year and a half, an oil producer was going to get at least $120 oil. But everyone thought they were going to get, let's say, 80 or 85. Well, so it's sort of similar like that for some of these services companies where they were already doing a lot better. They had already exited Q1 way further along than people thought. But a lot of the stocks actually sold off after their Q1 reports because January and February were so terrible. And then March was great. And then April and May were sort of on track to be even better. And so it's like, hey, like I have almost half the year painted out for me right now. Mostly crystallized, and then I have the trajectory for the second half of the year. And I'm not that short-term oriented, but for any business, especially for a business that's very economically levered, very financially and operationally levered, if I can know what's going to happen for a good part of the next 18 months, of course I'm going to bet on that, especially if I can get that sort of business at a giant discount to where it traded historically and versus, various key metrics like book value and, free cash flow yield and so on. So there's this really weird opportunity still, I think, in the services stocks, where it's felt like just leaning down and picking up $100 bills off the ground.
Yeah. Okay. And do you look mostly in North American companies in the US and Canada, or are you open mind to worldwide companies?
Yeah, so I look all over. I'll admit that my historical track record, similar to you, had asked about exploration stocks. My track record on these things, you don't want me to buy your exploration stock because if I do, then you're going to get some bad news about how they had some exploratory issue and so on. I try to do what I'm good at, and I'll do a little. I own a little bit of, have some exposure to a few different exploration plays internationally. And I'm open to that. I just want to get compensated for it. And I feel like there's a lot of geopolitical risk in many places, including the US and Canada. But the US and Canadian risk, I feel like it's very easy to appreciate being in the midst of it. Whereas the risk in XYZ South American or sub-Saharan African or East Asian country is a lot. You can get up to speed from sort of an academic perspective. You can even sort of go quiz locals. But if you think about the equivalent of going and asking 10 people about Donald Trump's energy policy and then thinking that that's going to help you know what Trump is actually going to do with his energy policy, there's a degree of humility, I think, that's necessary, and that I try to incorporate into my efforts in investing beyond, let's say, North America and oil and gas.
Got it. Okay. If there's one thing, one suggestion or piece of advice you can give to investors that maybe don't have any exposures to this space, what would that be? What would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to not FOMO into this. So to not there's I think people are very worried and feel that on days where oil's up a lot, they sort of panic buy. But then sort of the flip side is that, and so like panic buying or selling is generally not a good plan. You should, talk to your financial advisor and have sort of a reasonable long-term plan and act on it. But the sort of flip side to that is I think that sort of across the market, index funds, allocators, brokers, individual investors don't have enough oil exposure for the most part. Oil and gas is about 3% of the US stock market by market cap, where it's over 10% of the US economy from an earnings perspective and GDP perspective. And so I think people have way too little, let's say, structural energy exposure versus where we're at cyclically for oil and gas. But at the same time, I see way too much sort of excitement behavior in both directions, where people are panic buying oil stocks when oil's up a lot in a day, and then panic selling when it's down a lot. And so, one, don't panic. And then, two, try to make sure that whatever your allocations are fit your long-term plan, but actually fit not just aren't just sort of cookie cutter based on, all the endowments they follow this. I have this David Swensen book, they all try to copy what Yale did 30 years ago. And since they're all doing it, it sort of has inevitable problems.
Right.
Individual, brokers do 60-40 or various other sorts of plans like that. Generally, if everyone's doing it, maybe it's a good idea to at least adjust it slightly.
Got it. Well, Josh, you launched in a newsletter, you said about a year ago. I actually saw that on LinkedIn recently. You've been doing really well. Tell us about your newsletter and tell us about how people, if they want to get in touch with you, if they want to do business with you, how do they do that?
Sure. Yeah. So my main business is investing money for clients, mostly family offices and high net worth people. And that's through an investment firm that I co-founded 11 years ago. And I realized a year ago that people just weren't, they just didn't own enough oil stocks, like we were saying, didn't have enough exposure to energy more broadly. And so I launched this newsletter as a sort of side project to share some of my stock ideas and some sort of market perspectives on oil and gas. And it turned into, it was sort of this like side passion project, and it turned into quite a success. We have over 1,000 paid subscribers to this thing, and
Congratulations.
thank you. And the stock ideas have done really well. And so yeah, it's super fun. I think it's the most fun thing that I do. And it's built this sort of whole community. And it was just this, like, I just had this view. I was chatting with my analyst at my investment firm early last year, and it's like, wow, people just don't get this. And he's like, what are you going to do about it? And it's, well, let's all do, I can't solve it for everyone, but I can do my part to solve it. And so that's, and it's called the Bison Insights. And I just stuck it, I put it on Substack just because that seems to be a place where a lot of people do this. And I want it to be sort of very standard and sort of easy to access and not too expensive. And so launched it in August of last year. And also I'll just share, like, the first day or two you launch it and like a few people sign up and say, uh-oh, like, what
Right.
I sign up for, what am I committed to? And then I just sort of jump all the way in before seeing a proper response. And I'm really, really pleased with it. It's been really educational and fun to go and help explain how I invest in oil and gas.
And where do they go for that, for your newsletter? What's the
Sure, it's a
URL?
bisoninsights.info.
Got it. Colby, my producer, will link to that both in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Josh, have you suddenly gotten rid of any swag? I know you had some swag last time I talked to you.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I've got this. So we have some of this stuff on the on a there's this like Printify site. I just donate the proceeds to the net proceeds to the zoo at this point. I think if I donate them enough money, maybe they'll do another bison exhibit. There's no bison exhibit at the Houston Zoo, sadly. So I've got my drill baby drill hat and then the 250 WTI hat back there. And I think people sort of get the wrong idea with the 250 WTI, and I think that oil should be at that right now. And it's more just, I think that producers should be drilling more, thus the drill baby drill hat. And the 250 WTI, the thought is that cyclicals at the end of cycles, they tend to end the cycle at a new all-time high price, inflation adjusted. And so you look at where oil had gone to in the 2008 cycle, and it sort of peaked out right around $150 a barrel. And then you think about how expensive things have gotten versus how expensive they were in 2008. An extra 40% or whatever doesn't seem like that much of a stretch. So 250 is where it's at.
Yeah, fantastic. Josh, always a pleasure. Loved having you on. Great insights. Love to have you on again in the next few months to see where we're at, where we are at.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate coming on.
Thank you.